If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. For three decades in the middle of the 20th century, Cary Grant was a bona fide Hollywood icon. A sex symbol, money-making machine, and the epitome of debonair sophistication. Yet his formative years in pre-war Bristol were marred by poverty and his mother's mental illness. Mark Glancy's new book, Cary Grant, The Making of a Hollywood Legend, traces this remarkable transformation. Here, in conversation with our production editor, Spencer Mizzen, Mark discusses the life of one of Britain's greatest ever acting exports.
So, Mark, as you point out at the very beginning of your book, Cary Grant declared in 1984 that, quote unquote, "I definitely don't trust biographies." So with that in mind, what inspired you to write one about him yourself? What is it about him that you find so compelling?
Well, I suppose two things. One is that I lived in Bristol when I was a postgraduate student, and I saw where he was from and was quite surprised to find out that he was from such a humble background. He was from a very working class family and neighborhood. So a lot of my interest was about how he got to be Cary Grant. How do you go from being a relatively uneducated working class boy in 1910 to being the most sophisticated, glamorous, debonair man in the universe just two decades later. So that was a major factor in deciding to write the book. The other thing was that there have been many biographies of him written, and I think so many of them are like historical fiction. They aren't very reliable. They don't have adequate referencing. A lot of it seems to be speculation about him. And so I really wanted to write something that was much more factual and documented.
Sure. And as you just kind of alluded to there, what distinguishes your biography from others is, I guess, the fact that you were able to gain access to his own personal papers. I mean, can you tell us how that came about? And what do the papers tell us about Grant that we didn't already know?
Well, the Cary Grant papers are held as a collection at a library in Los Angeles. And they've been available for quite some time, but no one had used them before in writing a biography of him. It seems to me no one has ever used them really at all because they have so much information in them. And from the first time, I was very skeptical about the papers because I thought, well, these have been available for 10 years. They will have been trawled through. There must not be anything really remarkable here. And then, from the very first day, it was clear that there were a lot of personal documents, a lot of things about his upbringing, his family, his childhood, as well as a lot about his career. Everything from contracts to annotated scripts to correspondence with some of the key directors he worked with, Alfred Hitchcock, for example. So I really thought it was a treasure trove. And it was the first day in the archive that I thought, oh my, there's not only a book here, there's a long book here.
And am I right in saying that he kept a lot of these papers in this incredible vault in his Beverly Hills mansion?
Yes, I think this stemmed partly from his Bristol past, that several members of his family were killed in the Bristol Blitz. And their homes were completely destroyed in 1940. And so they lost a lot of family documents that way. And I think he had this in the back of his mind that his own personal archive could be lost to fire, to mudslides, this sort of thing, because he lived way up in the Beverly Hills. And at the time, where he lived was quite remote. It's not really anymore, but it was a high spot and a spot where you might get a fire or a mudslide. And so I think to keep all this stuff safe, he had a steel walk-in vault built into the side of his house, as you do. And he kept all the stuff there. Some of it just, you know, sort of packed away there, some of it on display. And various people who knew him throughout his life commented on how much time he spent in the vault, putting things away and looking at things. And so it was a big part of his life, I think, this vault.
And was it also partly the fact that it had been in his own lifetime a few kind of biographical hatchet jobs done on him? Was this his kind of way of ensuring that an accurate record of his life was kept for posterity?
I think so. There's always been an approach to writing about Cary Grant that is, this man seems so handsome and charming, he must really be a devil. You know, the desire to expose him and to find something malevolent and unattractive in him has driven a lot of the writing about him. And so I think he was determined to have this record of his career, at least as he saw it, and document his past in that way.
Now, this is a story of, in many ways, a great celebrity, success, wealth. But I guess it's also, to some extent, a story of triumph over adversity. I mean, like you said earlier, Grant was born into a working-class family in Bristol. And as you mentioned in the book, his mother, Elsie, was committed to Bristol Lunatic Asylum when he was very young. So his wasn't an easy upbringing. I mean, I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about his early years.
Well, by all accounts, up until the time his mother was committed, he had a fairly happy and ordinary childhood for a working class boy of that time. He was very bright. He was top of his class in school. He had friends. He was getting along fine, it seems. And then one day when he was 11 years old, he came home from school and found that his mother wasn't there. No one would tell him why. So she simply disappeared as far as he was concerned. And after a while, some cousins told him that actually she was dead and that he would never see her again. But I'm not sure whether he really believed that because he didn't have a grave to visit and there was no funeral. And so I think he grew up assuming that his mother had deserted him. And that he would never see her again. And it wasn't until he was 30 years old, that his father, not quite on his deathbed, but very nearly on his deathbed, said, by the way, your mother's still alive. She's in what was called the Bristol Lunatic Asylum. And you can only imagine the impact that would have on someone who hadn't seen their mother since they were 10 years old.
So did he get back in contact with her after that?
He did. Immediately. And she was released from the asylum and she lived another 40 years and he supported her for the rest of her life. The story has a happy ending in that sense, but it wasn't easy. They had to rebuild their relationship. They really struggled to do that, to rebuild the relationship. One of the amazing things that I found in the archive was there was a file labeled correspondence with Elsie Leach, his mother. And I thought, oh, I wonder what that's going to be. And, you know, maybe a postcard or two. It was more of a box than a file. And it had letters from the 40 years that she lived after getting out of the asylum. All of these letters from her. And he kept a lot of his replies too. He kept copies of his replies, and so I could see how they rebuilt their relationship, and I could see how difficult it was.
Now, how did he get his big break? I mean, and how did he go about learning his craft as an actor?
When his mother disappeared, childhood became very difficult. His father didn't really look after him very well. He was left on his own a great deal of the time. He got expelled from school at the age of 14. But the one great love of his life at that point was the music hall, the theaters that had variety acts in them. And so he worked at the Bristol Empire, and he worked later at the Bristol Hippodrome as a backstage runner. And I think he found his alternative family there. He found a lot of warmth and supportive adults there, people who looked after him. When he was expelled from school, he joined one of the acts that had been playing at the Hippodrome, the Pender Troupe of Acrobats. So his big break. He is that little boy who ran away to join the circus. You know, he joined the Pender Troupe of Acrobats. They didn't actually play circuses, but they toured Britain first and then America as an acrobatic troupe. And so that I think is where he gets his incredible physical agility that you see on screen. His grace, his physical grace comes from this long, intense training he had as an acrobat. That he did that for 7 or 8 years.
So, who first spotted his talent in Hollywood?
Well, he had a hard time getting to Hollywood. He took he did a couple of screen tests where he didn't do very well, and they didn't like him. They didn't like his accent, for one thing. He had a very thick neck, and it took him a while to learn how to hide that, how to use collars to hide his thick neck. So eventually, he went to Hollywood. He'd done a couple of tests in New York that didn't go well, but he was on Broadway at this time. He was in musicals on Broadway in the late 20s and early 30s. And he went to Hollywood simply to try and have another screen test. And they gave him a test, and I think someone took more care with him. Someone bothered to groom him properly and light him properly. And that's when he got his first contract at Paramount.
You mentioned his accent earlier. I noted an anecdote in your book where you write that John Kennedy and his brother Robert would phone Cary Grant from the White House and laughingly demand, "Let's hear your voice." Now, he was known for his kind of distinctive transatlantic accent. I think is that fair to say?
Yes.
But I imagine at one point in his life, he sounded quite Bristolian, a bit like me. So, you know, where did this distinctive accent come from?
He did sound, well, I think you can hear Bristol in his accent, and even 6 or 7 decades down the line, that he maintained a little West Country intonation and burr in his accent. But once he joined the acrobatic troupe, he was based in Brixton, and at the time, Brixton had a sort of South London Cockney accent. And so I think you can hear a little bit of that in his voice too. And then when he got to America, obviously his accent was Americanized to some extent just from everyday life. But in his first Broadway contract, it was stipulated that he would have vocal training. So I think there's a bit of Broadway vocal training in there as well. And that's why the cadence of his speech is so pronounced, that he's trying to make himself easier to understand. And so it's a little bit of Bristol, it's a little bit of Brixton, and it's a little bit of Broadway, all mixed together.
There's another great Grant quote that you cite in the book, and that is, "Everyone wants to be Cary Grant. Even I want to be Cary Grant." Now, I thought this kind of gets to the heart of your book, because you've got the idea of this working class Englishman who was originally called Archibald Leach becoming this kind of debonair, dashing Hollywood icon, Cary Grant. I mean, that image must have taken a bit of cultivating. Is it something he really worked hard on, and is it something he found difficult to sustain?
I think it was something that he worked hard on. I think there's no doubt that he worked very hard on it, and particularly being able to act for the camera in a way that maintained the grace and the incredible sense of decorum that he has on screen. If you watch his early films, and he made 25 films in his first 5 years in Hollywood. If you watch the early films, you can see him learning how to act for the camera. And part of that is how to be attractive for the camera, because he's not quite as handsome in his early films as he becomes later on. And he talked about this at the time, that he had to learn how to hold his chin so that he didn't get a double chin, this sort of thing. And I mentioned earlier, he had to, he learned how to use collars to hide his neck. So a lot of what we assume is his natural handsomeness is actually very, very skilled presentation of himself. He also, you know, famously became the best dressed man in Hollywood, and I think you can watch him get better and better at learning how to wear clothes and choose clothes as well.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
When he was an adolescent, he grew up wondering why his mother had left him, and so he was filled with insecurities generally, but I think insecurities particularly about women.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it, so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
So what made him so irresistible to the opposite sex and to the cinema going public on both sides of the Atlantic? I mean, what was the secret of his enormous success?
Well, I think once he learned how to look good on camera and how to act well on camera, there was always the possibility that he would just look perfect. And I don't think people like perfection necessarily. They might resent it. They might find it annoying. So the real key to how he won people over, I think, is that he was always willing to play the clown, and he was always willing to slip on a banana peel or do some sort of slapstick comedy. He was always willing for his clothes to be ripped to shreds sometimes when he was wearing them. So there's a dynamic there that I think people like. They go into a Cary Grant film thinking, oh yes, I know Cary Grant. He's so smooth. He's so polished. He's so debonair. Then they enjoy once again seeing all of that stripped away from him. So, you know, a lot of films, he has his clothes stolen, and he ends up wearing something totally inappropriate, or he ends up, you know, covered in some kind of muck or something like that. And so he knew how to appeal to the audience in that way.
And how famous was he? I mean, was he one of, say, the top five Hollywood stars in the world at any time?
Yes. He, from about 1937 until he retired in 1966, he was easily the best paid Hollywood star. He was tremendously effective at negotiating contracts and getting more money, but he was also one of the best known, most popular leading men. There, funnily enough, it's at the end of his career, when he's 60 years old, that he's regularly in the top five most popular stars. So he left on a high note. Up until that time, he might have been, you know, in the top 10 or in the top 20, but in the early 1960s, when he's making his last films, North by Northwest, Charade, Father Goose, he's number one or number two.
And did he enjoy the trappings of his success? Was he comfortable living the life of a Hollywood icon?
Well, having been born into poverty, and having experienced some considerable hardship, particularly as an adolescent, I'm sure he enjoyed the financial stability that he had, the wealth that he gained. But one of the nice things that I found out about him, one of the things that I admired about him, was that he was never into the trappings of wealth. So the house that he bought in, lived in for decades in Beverly Hills, the one that has the vault in it. By the standards of Beverly Hills, it's quite a modest house. It was a three or four bedroom, what they call a farmhouse. He didn't throw his money around. He did buy a Rolls Royce. He did like his Rolls Royce, and he collected Impressionist paintings, most of which he eventually donated to a museum. But by and large, he lived a fairly humble life, free of excess and free of pretensions.
Can we talk about his personal life? I mean, he was married, am I right in saying, five times?
Yes, five times.
I mean, why? I mean, that suggests his love life was quite turbulent. I mean, I wonder if you could just elaborate on that a little bit, please.
So he was married five times. And when he wasn't married, he was quite often involved with women for long periods of time. He had some long affairs and quite intense affairs that looked like they were going to head for marriage. So there, it was a turbulent love life. There were many, many breakups. I think every one of the women he was involved with said that they had a great time together. He could be a lot of fun. In many ways, he was a wonderful partner, but that he also had many issues surrounding trust and that he could be quite paranoid and distant and anxious as well. And I think this stems from his mother's disappearance, that when he was an adolescent, he grew up wondering why his mother had left him. And so he was filled with insecurities generally, but I think insecurities particularly about women.
For years, rumors swirled that he was homosexual. I mean, how did this impact upon his career? And do you give the rumors much credence?
I don't think the rumors impacted his career because they weren't that openly discussed. You know, from the time he was famous, from the 1930s through the early 1960s, you know, to some extent, homosexuality was the love that dare not speak its name. It wasn't talked about. And so it didn't really impact his career. There has been a lot of speculation, that he was gay. And one of the things I think I wanted to say at the outset of my book was that I don't think he was primarily gay, and I don't think he was even primarily bisexual, because when you look at his life and when you look through his relationships and see his correspondence and get a sense of his personal life, he was involved with women intensely every step of the way. And so I think I was very careful to say, this isn't to say that he never had any homosexual experiences. I'm just saying this was a man who was very interested in heterosexuality. And I think the other way we see, one of the things that I was able to gain access to was his home movies. He was an avid home movie taker from the 1930s onward. So very early, he had this 8mm camera and that he loved filming around the house and when he traveled and so on. So I could sort of see the world through his eyes. He so often points his camera at attractive women. You know, it's a pretty good example of what in film studies we call the male gaze, that he likes to point his camera at attractive women and objectify them in that sense. So I felt as though I was looking through the lens of a heterosexual man.
You also recite an anecdote where he arrives at his great friend Alfred Hitchcock's house to be greeted with the words, "I hope you'll forgive me, Carrie, but we are out of LSD." I mean, did he have a bad drug habit?
Oh no, he didn't have a bad drug habit at all. He took LSD when it was still legal and under medical supervision. So this was a form of psychotherapy for him. He would go to a doctor's office every Saturday and take LSD under this doctor's supervision and have an 8-hour LSD trip through which he explored his unconscious. And he attributed this with freeing him from a lot of the insecurities and anxieties that stemmed from his childhood. So he became an advocate of LSD while it was still legal. He wanted everyone to do LSD. He really thought that right, we would all be better off if we did a lot of LSD. But as soon as it was illegal, he stopped advocating it and stopped doing it.
Now, in the book, you examine each of Grant's, is it 72 films?
72 films.
72 films. And that's a hell of a lot of films. I mean, if you could you point out three that you would deem the greatest?
That is a tough question. I mean, I can start off with North by Northwest. Everyone should see North by Northwest. It's a very important film, not only for him, but an important film in film history more generally. Choosing a comedy, choosing one of the comedies is very difficult. I'm going to go with Bringing Up Baby because that is a delightful film and another really key film in film history, a key screwball comedy. And now, where do I go for the third film? He was nominated for an Oscar for a film that's I think largely forgotten, called Penny Serenade. Which has elements of comedy, but it's really a melodrama and quite a sad film. And he has a key moment in it where he cries on screen. And so I think just for the sake of diversity, I'll choose Penny Serenade.
And which of the many very famous leading ladies that he acted alongside would you say he worked best with?
Well, he would have said Grace Kelly. He thought that Grace Kelly was the best actress he ever worked with, and he loved the way they interacted on screen, and they improvised a lot of what they did in To Catch a Thief with her. So he would say that. I actually prefer him with Katharine Hepburn. I think they make a wonderful team, and that they bring out the best in each other. That she shatters his reserve and his polite demeanor quite effectively, and he encourages her to be even more outspoken and more liberated than she normally is in her films.
Would you describe him as a great actor? I mean, where does he stand in the pantheon of Hollywood greats?
Well, he has been described as the greatest actor in the history of cinema by no less a source than David Thompson, who's one of the greatest film critics of American cinema. So he has a lot of admirers. I think and of course some people react to that with dismay and say, how can you say Cary Grant was a great actor compared to someone say like Laurence Olivier or Marlon Brando?
Well, why would they say that?
Because there was the idea that he didn't play the kind of diverse roles that someone like Olivier played, and he wasn't a method actor in the way that Brando was. You don't see the kind of emotional upheaval in him that you see in Brando. So there's a sense that he wasn't that classical actor that Olivier was. He wasn't the method actor that Brando was. But I think Thompson's point, calling him the greatest cinema actor ever, is that he learned so well how to act for the camera. He was a master of the absolute slightest movements, the raising of the eyebrow, the flicker of the eyes. That those early years in Hollywood where he made so many films so quickly, he really studied his performances and learned how to act for the camera in a way that few other people have mastered.
And did his acting change over the years, his acting style?
I don't think his acting style changed. I think what changed was he got better at it. He got more and more skilled at it. And part of that came from working with some really important directors. And so working with Howard Hawks, working with Alfred Hitchcock, George Stevens, George Cukor, these are the Hollywood greats. And I think he got something from working with each of them in terms of performance skills and learning how far he could go in terms of his performances.
And how did he change Hollywood? What is his greatest legacy?
I think his greatest legacy in terms of the industry, in terms of Hollywood as an industry, was that he was one of the first stars to break free of a studio's control. So at the time he came to Hollywood in the early 1930s, it was normal for stars to sign an exclusive contract with a studio that lasted 5 years, 6 years, 7 years. And they had no control over their careers. They got paid a lot of money, these stars, but they were completely beholden to the studio and had to do what the studio said. No choice over anything. They didn't choose their directors. They didn't choose their co-stars. They didn't even choose which films they made. And during that time, the 5 years that he was with Paramount, he really came to resent this and thought that they weren't doing a very good job with his career. The studio bosses weren't. And indeed, they weren't. His career really wasn't going anywhere for those first 5 years. And so he took an incredible risk by breaking out of that. As soon as he could leave Paramount, as soon as his contract was over and he was able to walk out the door, he did. And everyone told him he was crazy to do this, that it was probably the end of his career. But he put his career together as an independent star, and slowly but surely came to insist on, I'm going to approve the script, I'm going to approve the director, I'm going to approve my co-stars. And really early on, he says, I'm going to take a percentage of the gross, the box office gross. And this is where we are. This is where we've been in Hollywood since the 1960s, at least, that stars really run the show and they have their own production companies and they have big stars have control over every aspect of their careers. Well, he had this by 1940. Just about every other star in Hollywood looked at that longingly and said, I want to run my career. I want to have this kind of control. And he managed to get it very early on. Big stars like Betty Davis and Olivia de Havilland started fighting to have the same kind of power.
So could it be argued that of all British actors, he's the one who had the biggest impact on the American market?
Absolutely. Britain's greatest export, he's been called. Certainly Britain's greatest export to Hollywood. I don't think there's any comparison in terms of the kind of impact he had.
That was Mark Glancy. Mark's latest book, Cary Grant, The Making of a Hollywood Legend, is published by Oxford University Press. Thanks for listening. This episode was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in tomorrow to hear Catherine Neal discussing Edward I.